Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to the second podcast seminar on SaifEddin.com. This is Dr. SaifEddin Hammous, and I am here to have the weekly meeting of this seminar wherein we discuss the courses that are offered on SaifEddin.com, and we discuss Bitcoin and the economics of Bitcoin and economic questions in general and more widely. Today, I'm going to begin our discussion with the by pouncing on the news of the blackouts in California to make a point on energy, which is going to be a part of my forthcoming textbook in economics. And this is something that was not included in the course. When I taught the course, I had not included a lecture on energy. But as I was writing the textbook, and as the ideas, the courses, I should say, right? I did two courses for this book, Economics 11 and Economics 12. And as I was writing those textbooks, as I was preparing those courses, I focused on the topics of economics as discussed in the textbooks of Mises and Rothbard and Menger. But in writing my own textbook, in trying to crystallize and synthesize all of those ideas and write them out, I decided
that I must add a chapter specifically on the economics of energy. And I think it's an enormously important point, and it's enormously important part of daily life, of people's daily existence. And it's a it's so fundamentally important to our ability to live modern life, what we come to expect from modern life, and yet it's so widely misunderstood. And I think the misunderstanding of energy is ultimately related to the misunderstanding of economics, or the little understanding that people have of energy is very related to the lack of understanding in of economics in general, which is something that we've touched upon in the courses and in my book. So what's interesting about what is happening in California is effectively, and I recommend looking into the work of Alex Epstein. And I've had a recent interview with Alex Epstein, which I'm going to be releasing on my podcast. I think it may have actually been released, or it will be released over the next couple of weeks. So if you follow this podcast, you'll get an interview that I did with Alex about a couple of weeks ago, where we discuss Bitcoin and energy and economics. He's a good writer, and I really recommend his work. He's written a book called The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. So he's been following this, and he's got some very good ideas on this. And he's also been discussing it on his podcast with Mike Schellenberger, who has just written a very good book called Apocalypse Never. And Mike Schellenberger is a previous, he is still an environmentalist. And he's somebody who's been very active in the environmentalist movements in the U.S., and particularly in California, for quite a while. But he's grown quite weary of the constant state of apocalypse that is upon us every day now. And he has essentially, he says that he has teenage daughters, and he just began to realize how much anxiety teenagers are suffering because they think apocalypse is coming. And he realized, you know, as an environmentalist, he really needs to come out and make a statement about this, that no, actually, you know, the world is not ending anytime soon. There's no evidence to suggest that is the case, and we shouldn't be so freaked out about things. So I highly recommend their work in general, but they were also talking about this issue in California and the California energy blackouts. And what it boils down to is effectively that California has been the nation leader in new cutting edge sustainable renewable technology. And this is the natural consequence of it. And you may have heard the term the Green New Deal bandied about by people who want to, you know, revive the U.S. economy by investing in green energy technology instead of dirty fossil fuels. And so this has been a massively successful hustle over the last 40 years in the U.S. Since really the 1970s petroleum scare, there has always been money to be made by telling people that you're selling them something called green energy, as long as you stayed away from dirty fossil fuels. And California, of course, has been the world leader at that. And this has led to the decommissioning of gas plants. Instead of replacing and maintaining gas plants, essentially the power monopoly and the power providers in California have been investing in cutting edge, new, green, renewable energy rather than investing in maintaining their quite high quality and perfectly serviceable and reliable natural gas plants, as well as nuclear plants. And they've decommissioned those plants, and instead they're relying on wind and solar and all kinds of voodoo. That is, you know, sounds nice in principle because, oh, look, you know, it's a windmill. It makes energy without having to dig under the ground and get dirty oil out, and it doesn't make gas. And it sounds like it's such a nice idea, but it's in reality a terrible idea. And I think, you know, understanding the economics of energy is really helpful in understanding why this is a terrible idea. And it's something that I've studied for quite a while because I did, in my undergraduate, I studied actually mechanical engineering. So I've always had this kind of interest in these topics. And then in my graduate studies, I also looked into this topic because I was actually, I did my PhD on the question of biofuels, of all things. And so I've had some familiarity with the topic. Now, obviously, I don't claim my expertise because I have the PhD on it. I'm mentioning this just in passing. But the interesting thing to think about when it comes to these energy sources is why is it that blackouts happen in places like California when they start switching to these fossil fuels? And I think the economic way of thinking, in particular marginal analysis, which is the topic of the first lecture in the first course on safetyd.com, Economics 11, Principles of Economics, marginal analysis is really very useful for understanding economics of energy, for understanding energy in particular, for understanding why blackouts happen when people switch to these energy sources, and why, to be very realistic about the world, we are going to have to be using hydrocarbons for the foreseeable future in significant quantities.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on safetyd.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with a nice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
If we like things like surviving the winter and traveling at a speed faster than a bicycle and electronic devices and electricity and modern sewage systems, the reality of it is that in order to produce the most valuable technological inventions and the most valuable, not necessarily the most valuable, some of the most valuable and some of the most important technological inventions that make our modern life possible, that have really improved life over the last couple of hundred years, what you need is power. What you need is power, not energy. And the distinction between the two is enormously important. And the distinction is the is the reason why fossil fuels or hydrocarbons, as I prefer to call them, are a better bet for quite likely a significant amount of time. So in my book on in the chapter on energy, the key thing I think to keep in mind is there is a, or let's begin with the distinction between energy and power. Specifically, power is equal to energy over time. It is the time intensity of energy. And so energy refers to the it's quite interesting actually that modern physics and modern science, for all of their self-righteousness about things, they don't have a it's not easy to come up with a very clear definition of what energy actually is. You'd expect it to be much more of a straightforward definition, but actually there's differences about how it is defined. One way that it is defined is that energy is the capacity to do work. Energy is the you know, the difficult thing about defining it, of course, is that it is not a substance, it's not a physical substance, but it is some property, some capacity within a within an organism or within a or within a physical object that allows it to do work or generate heat. This is one way of defining it. And it's a little bit of an ambiguous project, ambiguous definition, but it's the starting point of it's the starting point of analysis in thermodynamics and in physics. Power, on the other hand, refers to that energy divided by time. So power refers to how much energy is being exacted at a process during a specific period of time. So it refers to the time density of energy. And the distinction of this, people think that we need energy, makes them think about energy in the aggregates. You know, they think about energy, what we need in order to get energy is we need this certain amount of joules in order to produce energy. But in reality, what we need is power. What we're looking at is a very high amount of joules per second. That's the power that we that is the power that is needed. And the reality is, if you're going to have a if you're going to live a world in, you know, if you want to live in a life in which you have access to electricity reliably, where you're able to turn on your washing machine when you want to, not when, you know, the gods of the sun and the wind decide to blow in your favor, and if you'd like to turn on your laptop, if you'd like to have the modern piping that makes sewage possible, you need you know, high power, and you need that to be there. Let's put the sewage again aside for now. Actually, the piping. Let's just talk about domestic use. To simplify this, let's to simplify the analysis of power. Think about domestic use. The things that you need power for, which honestly, I think people in the West and in the industrialized and civilized countries that manage to have 24 hours for granted, they don't realize how much you need electricity in your daily life, because your entire life, you grew up in a life, in a place where every time you flick a switch, the light goes on. Every time you turn on the washing machine, it just goes on. You know, it's part of life. It's almost like part of your biology, you know, that you always have a switch and it's always on, and you don't have to ask anybody about it. You don't have to call people, and you don't have to have special favors from the neighborhood You take these things for granted. But as somebody who has lived in Beirut, Lebanon, and has experienced the devastating and horrible impact of power cuts and lack of power, it's amazing how much our modern life depends on 24-hour unconditional access to power. And this might sound like, oh, it's just soft first worlder propaganda that, you know, you need power to live. No, this is it's a profoundly true fact about life, that the disruption of power, it's not just massively inconvenient, it's an enormous drain on productivity, and it's enormously disruptive, and it is essentially a massive reduction in the quality of life. That's the simple part of it. But I think once you start living there for a while, you start seeing that actually it's not just, you know, a reduction in the quality of life. It can mean a lot more damage that is far more destructive, and it can mean the difference between life and death in many places. You know, there are places in which children die because the hospital runs out of electricity and they can't keep the incubators running. And that's it. It's a child that's gone. It happens because you didn't have reliable power at that point. And to really understand this, I highly recommend Alex Epstein's book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. It's an excellent book because it just goes through these in your life, all of these essential uses for power that you take for granted in your day-to-day life, and shows you how in different places, you know, in many of those places, people don't think of many of their problems as being caused by the lack of power. But it's quite astonishing when you think about it, that just how much better life would be in a place like Lebanon if you had 24-hour reliable electricity. Everything would be so much better in a massively life-saving and life-enhancing way, that it would really... It's shocking to think that we, in this day and age, we still have places that haven't managed to figure out how to make electricity work for 24 hours. It's really astonishing. So the point is that you need these high power applications, and you need them on demand. You need them without having to wait for permission from anybody, and you need them regardless of meteorological conditions. And the reality for any grid is that if you wanted to provide people with 24-hour electricity, then they must have the ability to provide them with, let's say, whatever the maximum capacity is. They'd need to provide that on demand at any point in time, because you never know when that might happen. So for instance, you know, you get a particularly hot summer, everybody's using their air conditioning, or everybody's using their electric heaters. And at that time, you get a massive amount of load on it. And if at that point it's not very windy and it's not very sunny, which is quite likely, it's not likely to be very sunny in the very cold, for instance, and it's not likely to be very windy in the sweltering heat. When you have these situations, you have enormous demand for power, for high power, for washing machine and for drying machines and for air conditioners and for electric ovens and for all of these essentials of daily life and essentials of survivals, and, you know, also of course children's incubators for premature children and so on. All these things require 24-hour reliable energy, and there comes a point at which there is maximum demand. And if there is no maximum, and if there is no ability to meet that demand from the unreliable sources of energy, which are, you know, which is the correct term to use for what people call renewables. As Alex Epstein says, you know, they're better known as the unreliable sources of energy, the unreliables. The problem with the unreliables is that if they're not there at that time, you're still going to need to have a grid that provides you with that high amount of power on demand. And so for that, there really are only three options that are workable. There are really only three options that can provide high amounts of power on demand, unconditional on the weather. And those are A, hydrocarbons, B, hydroelectric energy, so energy that's connected to water dams, and three, nuclear energy. Those are really the three only reliable ways of getting 24-hour electricity and high supply of electricity. And there's simply no way that you can have a house where your switch works reliably, where the washing machine works reliably, where the you know, the daily basics of existence that ensure our safety and in life, there's no way to have these work reliably unless you have a grid that is connected to one of these three sources. You may not like it, but that's the reality. And I think the reason that I have a massive problem with the people that have problems with these sources of energy is that none of them will ever make their problems known to the world without the use of fossil energy. None of them will be able to get anywhere and travel anywhere without the use of these energies. None of them will be able to power their home without these three. So access to these three is essential. You're going to have them. Without them, I think this is really the problem, that the debate on energy can be silly at times, because certain people think about it in the sense of morality, as, you know, what is best, what feels nicer, whereas other people think about it in terms of engineering, you know, what allows your actual dishwasher to work, what allows your washing machine to work, what allows the incubators for children at hospitals to work 24 hours. So if you think about it from the perspective of making sure that all of these places have reliable 24-hour energy, as an engineer, you understand there is no alternative to those three sources. If you've got a water source near you that generates a lot of energy, you could hook up a hydroelectric dam, or you could have a power plant that's built on nuclear, or you could build fossil fuels or hydrocarbons. But if you want to think about the energy sources from a sentimental perspective, from what makes you feel good, from the perspective of virtue signaling, then, you know, you want to talk about things like wind and solar and biofuels and all that stuff. And that's just not workable. It's not really workable, and it's not possible to run the grid on it, because at peak demand you can't generate this enormous amount of power that people will require. And so you're going to need, as a backup, you're going to need a solar energy you're going to need a reliable source of energy as backup. So if you need a reliable source of energy as backup, that basically means that you just don't need the solar energy or the wind, because, okay, maybe you're saving a little bit on fuel costs, but, you know, you still need the power plant. You're still building the same power plant. And so the economics of it are highly, highly, highly suspect. And that's, I think, what's happening now. What's really tragic, if you think about it, in places like California, it's also happening in places like Australia, is that these places are beginning to experience third world and Lebanese style power cuts, thanks to the introduction of the future energy technology. And it's so it's so obvious what is going on, but it's amazing how marketing wraps people's brains around that they can watch as they basically go back to a grid that is functional at, I'd say, I think, you know, early 20th century level. This is, you know, when California first started getting electricity, maybe this is what the grid was back then. So they're going back 100 years thanks to the introduction of this stuff. And yet people still think of this stuff as being a more advanced form of energy. It's not more advanced because engineering is not a sentimental endeavor. It's not something about making you feel good about where you get your energy from. If you want to have the things that make modern survival possible, if you want to have 24-hour reliable electricity, you need investment in nuclear or hydrocarbon or hydroelectric. And for the vast majority of the world, I have to say, a lot of people take the cop-out of saying that, well, the answer is nuclear. And while I think nuclear is good, it's a bit of a cop-out to adopt the idea that, you know, oh, well, the answer is to just have nuclear. Because for the rest of the life of everybody alive today, even if you remove all of the nuclear restrictions, even if governments were to say, all right, nuclear power, and anybody can set up a nuclear plant, we have a complete nuclear free market, and if we don't have any massive accidents that cause enormous problems, and we continue to build full capacity nuclear all over the world, we still won't be able to eliminate fossil fuels. We still won't be able to eliminate hydrocarbons. We're still going to need them, even if only for their industrial uses and for all kinds of other uses. And you know, maybe we will eliminate them in a very future point in time, but that's a completely irrelevant consideration for pretty much anybody alive today, because for the rest of our lives, people are going to have to use hydrocarbons. You know, the amount of power infrastructure that's built around the world to produce hydrocarbons is not just going to be decommissioned because people feel better looking at windmills. People are going to understand one way or the other that this is an enormously cheap and reliable way of securing 24-hour electricity, and people are going to use this massive amount of existing infrastructure. So maybe we will add nuclear power, maybe we will have a lot of nuclear power, but in reality, we're not going to be able to eliminate nuclear power to the point. We're not going to be able to use nuclear power to completely eliminate hydrocarbons until the rest of the life of pretty much everybody living today, because we have so much capital invested and so much infrastructure that's invested in hydrocarbons that it doesn't make sense to just retool it all for nuclear. So there is no reliable alternative for the vast majority of humanity. There is really no reliable alternative for hydrocarbons except darkness. The vast majority of humanity don't live next to reliable hydroelectric sources. So that's extremely limited in how much energy it can generate. You have to live next to a place where there's a large source of water that moves fast, and that doesn't happen everywhere. And nuclear is still going to take a lot of time to roll out, just from a purely technical perspective, because it's an enormous amount of capital infrastructure investment. Power plants are built to serve not even 20 years, for 50 years and much more than that. You know, they're built for a very long term. So in places like China, they're building their new power plants on hydrocarbons, coal and gas. And the growth, you know, the developing world, if the people in the developing world are going to obtain first world living standards, going to come from the building of hydrocarbon plants. There's no escaping this, because nuclear energy is, you know, politically, it's not going to be solved very soon. But even if it was, completely liberalized politically, the political and the technical barriers—not barriers, but just the amount of capital investment that's going to take and the time that's going to take is going to be enormous. Because of this, I think, you know, people need to really come to terms with just the engineering reality of it, and the aspect of just the cost of the other energy sources is enormous in terms of reliability and access to 24-hour energy. And I think it's deeply worrying to see in many places in the world, power costs are rising enormously. And it's quite sad because, you know, the cost of energy, and that's the analysis in my book. So if you remember in Economics 11, we discussed energy from the perspective, we discuss economics as the, you know, it's the study of human action under scarcity. And effectively, I thought a good way of explaining that is how humans choose to increase the amount and value of time that they have on Earth. And you remember the structuring of the course was around all of these methods of economizing. And, you know, capital accumulation is one, labor is one, property is one, trade is another, money is another, entrepreneurship is another. And while writing the book, I decided that I must include energy as another one of these. And I think as a category, it should be included along with things like with things like money and trade and capital accumulation as an example of something that humans do in economizing, because utilizing energy, utilizing sources of energy into achieving our ends, into human action, is an enormously important determinant of what we are able to achieve. And I think it merits being included along with concepts like capital accumulation and trade and money as an economic act, as one of these aspects of human action. So from that, you know, thinking about the cost of energy, just how much a person is able to bring energy into their life, is the best way of understanding economic change in my mind. If you look at, and I get into this detail in my book, Principles of Economics, you can buy access to the draft of my book by going to my website, and under research, you can find you can buy access to the draft of the book, and you'll get a signed copy of the book when it is published next year. And you'll see it as a work in progress. It's currently at around 70,000 words. In this book, I outline when it comes to economics, you know, if you think about it, the history of human development, the history of human economics is really understood through the differences in the different sources of energy that we utilize. Under the world in which we lived as hunter-gatherers, you know, the energy that we could utilize was primarily our own body's energy. You know, we ran, and the energy of animals that we ate. So you'd run and you'd catch an animal and you'd eat them and you'd eat the energy inside them, and that would keep you alive long enough to catch the other animal. So the only sources of energy that you had were other animals that you ate. As we moved towards farming, you know, we started domesticating animals, and that was a way of us introducing more energy into our life. So we domesticate animals and use them for labor. So we ride animals, or we get them to we get them to help us with farming. And also we domesticated plants, so we use them to produce energy. So we throw a bunch of seeds in the ground, and then we get a bunch of fruits and grains that contain energy that we would take them. But our resources are still in the natural world, animals and plants. There are other living things that we use from other living animals, other living beings whose energy we consume. And then, you know, as civilization and technology and capital accumulation advances, we start utilizing more and more advanced or more advanced forms of energy. And a better way of thinking about it, maybe, than advanced, as an economist, you would think about it as cheaper sources of energy. We started finding ways of utilizing more and more energy and power in our daily life. So you see in, we started getting wind power and running water, using them for windmills and water mills. And of course, I should add, we used wood fire as well. Wood fire was also part of farming and pre-farming. That was also another source of energy that we had. But then, if you think about how much energy each of these sources could provide us, you had one horse, if you're lucky. So you've got the work of your own body and your horse. And so your ability to meet your own needs, your ability to economize for yourself, your ability to produce things for yourself is a function of really how many watts you're able to dedicate to meeting your own needs. And so when you had only your body, it's a different reality from when you have your body plus a horse. And it's a different reality from your body plus a horse plus a bunch of wood fire. But still, these are all, within kind of the same general ballpark of energy compared to what was to happen in the late second millennium when we started introducing hydrocarbons. Because that just increased the amount of energy that each individual could provide to themselves massively. In a way that was unprecedented. So if you look at the average American, for instance, today, you look at how much energy the average American has at their disposal, how much energy they consume per day, you would effectively see that it is equal to the amount of energy that is consumed by around 200 human beings. Effectively, the average American is able to have 200 slaves working for them day to day. Like the amount of energy that is being expended is if you wanted to have this 500 years ago, you needed 200 slaves to do that work for you. So if you think about it, and of course 200 slaves is that's really efficient. If you really wanted the same output, you'd need much more slaves, because modern machinery is much more efficient at using energy than slaves. Think about what it would require for you to have hot water on demand. Think about what it would require for you to have running water on demand. Somebody would need to get the water, boil it, and heat it, and put it through pipes for you. And that somebody needs to constantly, another person needs to be running to the woods, getting you wood fire every day. Think about how many people it would take to generate all of this amount of energy for you. Some things that might not even be possible. If you don't use wood fire, then you can't even have hot water, because no amount of slaves can heat water for you without fire. So you need to get them to use other, more intense sources of energy. But hydrocarbons allow us to have this sophisticated machinery that allows us to have hot running water, lighting. Compare lighting, how much candles you would need and how much money you would need to spend on candles and people to light the candles in order to give you this light. So what happened to us was a truly transformative event in humanity in the last few hundred years, when we've moved from living in a situation in which every individual had around one person's energy to dedicate their own life, plus fractions of an animal and some wood fire, and that was the amount of energy that you got. And we moved from that world to a world in which we, even the poorest people in the world today get something like 20, 30 slaves. Well, maybe not the poorest, but, some pretty poor people in the world, with the use of pretty cheap technology, can get a lot of slave labor working from them. And that was really only possible because of the utilization of sources of high power on demand, and of the massive reduction in the cost of energy and power that has been allowed to us through hydrocarbons. And that's really been the story of the last few hundred years. And nuclear, I think, you know, is a further step forward in it. And I think the real question is not about the move from hydrocarbons to these unreliable sources of energy. Effectively, people who will move to these unreliable sources of energy are going to pay the cost. But the majority of energy, the majority of actual energy that's getting produced in the world will continue to be coming from fossil fuels. And the question is whether we can, how much we can move toward nuclear. But I think the other important question which gets overlooked is the question of, you know, which of the fossil fuels is going to be used most. And the most important shift happening over the last 30, 40 years is the growth in the consumption of natural gas rather than coal. And that is a good thing because coal is dirty. There's no question about it. It can produce soot, and it's not a very good source of the environmental impact of it is of the plants that utilize coal are not is not ideal, and gas is much better. Having said that, you know, history shows that people very much prefer the pollution of coal plants to the misery and early death of, no coal plants. So coal is the cheapest and the earliest and the, well, I shouldn't say cheapest. It is probably the most expensive if you think about it in terms of the cost of energy. But it's the earliest form of energy, and it's the cheapest maybe in terms of initial cost. And a lot of the world's energy infrastructure has come from the building of coal. But, you know, places should be thinking about moving from coal to natural gas and potentially nuclear at some point, rather than wasting their time with these, wasting their time and resources and productivity on these horrific, unreliable sources of energy. If all of this, all of the resources wasted by unreliable sources of energy was instead invested in moving toward natural gas plants, it would have been so much better for so many more people. It would have given us so much more power at a much lower cost for so many more people all over the world. But, you know, people are really, really attached to their their unreliable sources of energy, I guess. All right. Anybody have anything to ask about this or to add about this?
Actually, I have. Let me first congratulate you for the new arrival. My question was about natural gas, because at the moment it's really expensive to ship it. You either can build a pipeline, which is quite difficult because of geopolitical tensions and other stuff, or you can ship it by special ships. But because it's really diffuse as a gas, you cannot ship a large quantity at competitive costs. I assume this is a matter of investment in real capital, but right now it's quite it's in some places it's still really cheaper to use coal.
Yeah, no, that's very true. The problem with natural gas is that it is not very energy intensive. It's in terms of weight, how much energy you can carry in terms of weight, it's not a lot because it's a gas. And they turn it into liquefied natural gas to increase its weight density. But oil is still a much better bang for the buck in terms of transportation. So you're right, gas is more reliant on pipelines than oil. And this is a true limitation in gas. But and of course, coal, you know, there's still enormous amount of investment in coal around the world. But if you look at if you look at the trend over the last 100 years, let me share this Let me share this graph from my book. This graph shows us what has happened to the energy supply, to the energy sources over the 20th century, from 1900 until 2016 or 18. This is data of how much energy has been produced from each of these sources. So we start off in 1900. Coal was about 95% of all the energy produced in the world. Oil was about 6 or 4, or I can't even tell, but, you know, something in these single digits. And then you had a tiny, tiny little sliver of gas. That was the state of the world in 1900. So it's important to understand that, you know, the world in 1900 was built on coal. You can have all kinds of sentimental objections to coal, but coal is why we have all of the nice things that we've had over the last couple of centuries. Up until 1900, the majority of the world was on coal. But what happened then was the explosion of oil in the 20th century. Oil continued to increase from the early 20th century until about the 1970s as a fraction. And since then, more or less, since the 1970s, we've stabilized at this kind of equation where coal, oil, and gas are each around a third of the energy supply. Gas was also growing through the 20th century, but it wasn't as growing as much as oil. Gas's growth up until the 70s, oil was the one that is growing the most. And then after the 70s, oil maybe shrunk as a percentage, although, of course, in absolute, it has increased. Oil consumption continues to increase, but it shrunk slightly as a percentage from the 70s until now. And that has been taken over by gas and coal. And so still, we live in a world in which 90% of energy sources come from, no, it's actually 85 at this point. You know, and now it's about 85% of energy comes from these three sources, and it's distributed about a third each, although natural gas is slightly smaller than the other two. And then other than that, we have hydroelectric energy is responsible for around 7 or 8%, I think. I'm not exactly sure. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I have the graph. I'll be posting it in the notes. And nuclear energy is around 3 or 4%. And then all of this unreliable hustle energy, ethanol, biodiesel, wind, solar, all of that stuff, all of that adds up to a cumulative 3 or 4 or 5% or something like that. And it adds up as a part of supply, but really, in my mind, it's more accurate to round all of this down to zero. It's really, it's there as the, you know, it's not a part of the team. It's this kid who's friends with the team that they brought onto the team to feel good about himself and pretend that he's part of the winning team, but they're not doing any work. You know, they didn't help with any actual work. They're an indulgence that is afforded to us because of the glorious high power that is afforded to us by fossil fuels and nuclear and hydro electric power. You know, because we have so much power from that, we can build all these insane wind farms and solar and solar plants and so on. But it's not something that produces any energy in a sense. It's not something that allows us to substitute away from these other sources, because fundamentally what it comes down to is that all of that infrastructure to produce these 3-4% is completely reliant on that other 95% in order for it to survive. So the reality is about 90% of our energy is hydrocarbons, and divided one third each between oil, coal, and natural gas. And then we've got around 10%, 10 to 15% to nuclear and hydroelectric. This is the reality of where our modern energy comes from. And I think people who think this is going to change soon massively underestimate just how much of a long-term investment how long the production structure of modern energy supply is. Like it's not something that just gets upgraded. You can't vote your way to getting a new solar plant next week. You can't vote a new nuclear plant next week. You can't decide to switch from coal to natural gas tomorrow just because you feel like it. It's a massively, massively expensive and long-term project. So investments happen and get paid off over a very long term. And we're stuck with this distribution, I think, for a while. The only way that I can see it massively being disrupted would be an enormous growth in nuclear. Whether that's politically likely or not is not something I can judge, but maybe nuclear power grows enormously and we get a very large increase in nuclear power. But still, even if we do, you know, it will eat into the share of oil. But I would not think that it would reduce the consumption of oil. You know, we will still continue to use oil, I think, for not just oil. I mean, oil, gas, and coal. I think all three are going to be around with us for a while because so much of our infrastructure is reliant on them. And that infrastructure is there and it's useful and we're going to keep using it. Does that answer your question, Theo?
Yeah, thank you. If I can just add something with regard to nuclear, mm-hmm. I'm from France and we developed nuclear really early. We still have something like 60 or 70% of our electricity that's come from nuclear. Mm-hmm. But with the arrival of the socialist / ecologist mindset, a lot of public servants have used the fear that people have about nuclear, because obviously it's a really technical subject and most people think that a nuclear plant is something like a nuclear bomb. And they used it to put regulations on top of each other, thus undermining the capacity of our firms to properly maintain good reactors and stuff like that. And thereafter, when the plants fail to pass some quality tests and stuff like that, they use it again as an excuse to replace it by silly wind turbines and stuff like that. So because I think because nuclear is really dangerous in the eyes of most people, it will always be used as an excuse by special interests with the help of public servants to undermine it with committees and different regulations.
Yeah. And I think it's increasingly appearing to me that nuclear is nowhere near as dangerous as people think that it is, but people think it's very dangerous and people are very resistant to it. So I don't see that changing any time soon, unfortunately. Well, I don't know. We could, but. You know, you're absolutely correct. The emotional aspect of it is shaping policy and shaping investment decisions. And I think the dangerous thing now, for me, I think it was only last year that we started to see this. We started getting power cuts in Australia and now in California. And I think if we start seeing more and more of this systematically, it's quite discouraging. There was also an interesting report in the UK. Actually, I should include notes on this because I'll include it in the notes. There's an interesting report that shows how much the introduction of unreliable energy has caused an increase in the cost of power to the UK citizen, because this is, and this was a new thing that I learned with the Corona crisis. One new lesson that I had not known about these unreliable energy sources before is that it's not only that they're insufficient at times of high demand, so you need to supplement with an entire fossil fuel power plant anyway. So you need to keep your fossil fuel power plant. There's another aspect to this catastrophe, which is that they're also very expensive to maintain when you have undercapacity. Because so when the world shut down because of Corona in March, demand for electricity in the UK plummeted. And when that happened, you had all this enormous amount of energy that was being produced by all these solar farms and wind farms, and you have nowhere to go with it. And so being able to discharge it and being able to deal with it is massively expensive for the power utilities. And it's causing blackouts and power interruptions, and it's causing the price to go up. So Chris is saying we could mine BTC with it. Not really. No, you can't. Some people say that, you know, you'll use renewable energy to mine BTC. You will absolutely not. It's the worst kind of thing to do with mining BTC. With mining BTC, you need your ASICs to be operational 24/7. If you're not turning on your ASIC 24/7, you lose. You are not even turning up to the game. You know, people turn them up 24/7 and get 6 cent kilowatt hour electricity, and sometimes still get wiped out when there's a Bitcoin crash. So 6 cents electricity might not be enough at running 24 hours. So if you have ASICs sitting there waiting for the wind to blow, I don't care how windy the place is, it's not going to have 24 hour wind. Well, maybe, you know, you might have 24 hour wind, very small amounts, but it's not going to be reliable. And that's going to mean that your ASICs are going to sit there idle for a significant amount of time. So it's just being depreciated without being used. And so there's absolutely no way you can redeem these. It's just a very, very, very expensive indulgence. It's not anything that's helpful or useful. So it's leading to a very large increase in the cost of power. But people are hoodwinked by the idea that they are so good, that they make people feel so good. It's sad.
Well, I just wanted to bring up the question of how I'm noticing other countries besides Germany wanting to move toward unreliable power sources. And we've talked about how that's really due to the fact that there's a lot of money to be made by people, you know, behind those sources. And I was talking to someone from Norway recently about how they're considering moving, you know, and they have tremendous oil reserves, certainly in the Arctic, as do, I think, four other countries. I think there are five countries that have Arctic oil reserves access: Norway, US, Russia, and two other Scandinavian countries, I think.
Finland, and Sweden.
Is that right?
I'd imagine, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that the same kinds of pressures are at work with the Norwegian government, if they're considering, with the example given of Germany, of how much more expensive it is, there must be enormous pressures at work there for them to be considering that. Those are smart, they're smart guys in Norway, you know.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's, I'm not sure what my question is really. I'm just observing that and going, wow.
Yeah, I think I've studied this for quite a while, and I think a significant turning point in it was in the 1970s when the price of oil shot up massively. Like, it went from $2 to about 30 something, and this is enormous. Like, for us now, it doesn't seem like such a big deal when we've seen oil go negative and so on, and we've seen it go from 200 to zero. But, you know, this is now, we are the children of the late stage fiat, to borrow a Marxist term. And we've been around the block, and we've seen oil come and go and rise, and we've seen crazy things happen. But for people in the 1970s, you know, they had only ever seen things stay at relatively constant prices. You know, inflation from 1914 didn't exist practically before 1914, except in random outbreaks here and there. But from 1914 onward, it was still relatively contained. It was only really in the 1970s when it shot up. And if you want to really think about it, I mean, imagine it was at $2 and then it shot up to three. Like it's to 300. So that's 15x. So if you want to think about the, I think a better way of understanding is imagine that the average has been, say, 0 to 100 over the last 10 years or the last 20, 30 years. And this is the number that you attach in your mind to oil. Now imagine that average over the last, that 10-year average multiplying by 15. So we go to $1,500 oil. This is what $30 oil must have felt like psychologically for people in the 1970s. And so it was a huge increase in the price. And what it ended up doing was that it brought energy front and center into everybody's mind, and it brought the energy market into everybody's mind, and it created an enormous need and desire and demand that people wanted to just get rid of oil because they didn't want to have to go through this again. They didn't want to have to be stuck in their suburban house, unable to move because their car needs $1,500 worth of gasoline. If you think about, well, $1,500, maybe not the right number, but it needs an exorbitant amount. And from then, there's an interesting book that was really influential on my PhD. It's called Energy Aftermath. It was written in the 1970s. I think that's a really interesting book because I was researching all of these alternative energies in the 2000s, you know, 30 years later. And there were all these ideas being bandied about the future is going to be biofuels and the future is going to be solar and wind and so on. And you go back to the 1970s and you see that it's basically the same thing. They've been recycling the same ideas from the 1970s until now. All of these promising technologies have been very promising since the 1970s. They continue to promise. And this book, Energy Aftermath, does an incredible job looking at what the energy policy of the 70s was and what the goals of it were, and then what the aftermath was. And so they look at it. Okay, so they said they wanted to implement this kind of energy source. What happened with that? It's quite amazing because what you see happen then has continued to happen nonstop since then, because it's just unleashed this massive industry of effectively government subsidized alternatives to fossil fuel, which don't need to actually deliver an actual alternative to fossil fuel. They just need to deliver the feel good aspect of getting people to think that there's going to be an alternative to fossil fuels. And that's it. That's what they do. You know, there's projections and graphs and numbers and people being extremely optimistic about what they're going to achieve. And then all these things end up being white elephants, or, you know, either they fail completely or they continue to trudge along living off subsidies, like the biofuels program, which is an enormous catastrophe in terms of the cost that it inflicts, not just the monetary cost, but the environmental cost in terms of farming all these lands with corn and just making them, empty, dead corn fields in order to produce corn and put it in cars. And it's just, and not just in the US, you know, and it's also true with biodiesel and palm oil in Indonesia and with sugarcane in Brazil. They're just subsidizing the pillaging of forests and agricultural land and pastures and turning them into disgusting monocropped fields for producing, you know, GMO corn that's going to then get extremely expensively processed into energy that's going to be extremely just wasteful as well as destructive to the car. It's not good. So all of these things continue to survive because I think there was an enormous industry unleashed from the hysteria of the 1970s. And they're just going to continue. It's kind of sad. But, you know, the good news, like with pretty much everything, the good news is that Bitcoin fixes this. Bitcoin fixes this on many different levels. Bitcoin fixes this first because it, the more people Bitcoin, the less governments can subsidize these kind of stupid ideas. But also, I think Bitcoin is massively powerful in the energy market. It's going to, as I discussed in that interview with Alex, and as I discuss in one of my research bulletins, which you can find on my website, on energy, and as I will be having discussing in my next book, The Fiat Standard, the ability of Bitcoin to allow people to monetize energy independent of location is going to be amazing, I think, because it allows people to monetize energy sources without having to connect them to the grid. And so it's the cheapest way of selling energy. And so I think that's just going to be a massive subsidy for cheap energy all over the world. And I think it's just going to finance the early stages of developing cheap energy sources all over the world. And it's going to be massively increasing in efficiency. And that's definitely one of the many interesting aspects of the economics of Bitcoin. Max, do you have anything to add?
Oh, not much. It's just because you just said there's this perception that nuclear energy is too dangerous. And I just wrote here on the chat, this is something I didn't know until very, very recently. There is this pharmacologist, Geraldine Thomas from Imperial College, who is self-declared a leftist. I don't know if she's still on that camp. And she used to fight nuclear energy a lot for many years, and until the day she went and did her homework and studied the whole thing, and now she's a big promoter of it, and she writes about it and so on. I put here a link to an interview with her, and she talks about this whole thing. Just could be worth looking at it.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting aspect. Alex Epstein also talks about nuclear weapon and about its safety. There was another question sent to me over the Telegram group. Somebody asked, it was based on the interview that Robert Breedlove had with Stefan Levera. So if you follow the Stefan Levera podcast, recently he interviewed Robert Breedlove. And Robert is a very interesting guy, and he's written some very cool pieces on Bitcoin. And in it, he discusses, the work of Mises and whether he thinks Mises was necessary for Bitcoin to emerge, or whether we would have had Bitcoin without Mises. And I think it's a very interesting question. I have to say, I think the impact of Mises is enormous, and I've always found it amazing that when you read Mises, there's this sense of he doesn't care about the people reading him in his day and time, and he's writing for people 100 years later. You know, he's writing this book so that people will one day look back and make sense of what is going on, and he is almost not concerned with what people, well, no, it's not true. He is, of course, concerned, but there is a sense of this being written for the future, this being written as something that is not going to bear fruit anytime soon, because the soil around him was so barren, if you want, intellectually. There were so few people around him anywhere that, and Robert says something which is along the lines of, you know, if Mises wasn't going around keeping this writing going on, maybe the Austrian school may not have survived. And I think there is an element to that. I mean, there was also Hayek, and you know, it's tempting to think that maybe Hayek could have done it, but I think no. The impact of Mises is absolutely instrumental, because, you know, from Menger to Rothbard, he was writing from that period, you know, from 1910 or 1912, he wrote The Theory of Money and Credit, until the 1970s. For 60 years, he was pumping out book after book after book and article after article after article in an enormous systematic project of explicating everything there is to be explicated about economics that, you know, it's really impossible to imagine what would happen to Austrian economics without him. And then, of course, you have to remember the aspect of him having set up his seminar in NYU. So he came to the U.S. and he couldn't get a job as a professor in the U.S. because, you know, American fiat universities were busy hiring math molesters rather than actual economists. But he did get an appointment as an adjunct in NYU, and he did organize one weekly seminar in NYU, which is still ongoing, by the way. And if anybody listening is in New York and interested in Austrian economics, I urge you to look it up. It's called the NYU Colloquium on Markets, and it is run currently by Mario Rizzo, an NYU professor and a friend of mine. Although I'm not sure, and I think he's still running it this year. He should be. I think it's still him who's running it. But it's the seminar where Rothbard became an Austrian, and you know, Mises had the seminar, and not just Rothbard, many people became influenced by him and became Austrian economists. And his influence on the survival of the Austrian school is enormous. And his influence, in my mind, I know I wouldn't just say it when I say the survival of the Austrian school. For me, it's not just an intellectual curiosity. For me, it's the survival of economic knowledge and of economics as a field, because, you know, the garbage that they teach in Keynesian textbooks is definitely not economics, even though it pretends to talk about economics. It has no relation to the field of economics. So I think without Mises, our understanding of economics would be massively hindered and encumbered. And it would be, we would be way, 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 way behind on this. Yes, Max just shared the link to the NYU seminar. I'm going to post that link, the colloquium. I've presented at it, incidentally, and I met Professor Joseph Lerner there and a whole bunch of the Austrians. Because when I was in New York, I became an Austrian in my last year, and I realized the seminar was there, and I went there. And they're very good people. And so that thing exists today because Mises was around, and that thing is what gave us many of the Austrian economists. So it's absolutely inspiring when you think about how Mises was going at this question and these topics and writing about them when this was completely unpopular, when this was completely ostracized within mainstream education. And yet what I find fascinating and personally inspiring, and it's something that helps me always focus my attention on what matters, is that if you look at the kind of silly Keynesian economists that were publishing things in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, nobody reads their books today. Nobody cares. Their own children don't know what they wrote in their books, because their books were a bunch of stupid, meaningless models of math that is completely unrelated to anything in the real world. And you know, it was what was necessary for getting a job at that time, and it was what made you publish, get published and keep your job and so on. And in order to do that, you have to, you know, go by the, once academics became influenced by government and heavily financed by government and subsidized by government, then it only became possible to, then education became separated from the free market, and success in publishing is no longer about publishing things that are useful for the market, that the market appreciates, because the market doesn't decide success in academia, government financing does. And so with that, in order to, when that becomes the decider, academic output becomes, at best political, but more likely nonsensical, as you see in many fields today, where people just publish stuff that nobody reads, nobody cares about, but it gets into journals where only academics read each other's work, and they essentially cross-reference each other, but nobody in the real world pays any attention to what is going on. That's true for the vast majority of academic research, and it's because it is separated from the market test. And it's inspiring to see how, 50 years later, after his death, almost 50 years after his death, millions of people all over the world know who Mises is and read his books, and people on Twitter have long arguments about what he said in his 1912 book and his 1922 book and his 1934 papers and so on. And people just continuously read it and discuss it and find inspiration in it. And it's amazing when you think about it with Mises' mentality, how he used to think in terms of just producing this, knowing that its time will come, knowing that it's going to be useful, how he continued to produce it and how he continued to write even as mainstream academia became completely alienated from him. He didn't discourage it. And for me, the fact that this book is being read today is the best vindication. And it's the best testament to what he's done. Having said all that, though, I'm going to take the other side on this and say, I'm not so sure how much Austrian economics has to do with the creation of Bitcoin. Let's be clear here. Nothing in the what I'd say is that Austrian economics help us understand Bitcoin, but it not necessarily inspired the creation of it. And I think Bitcoin is just better, more advanced, harder money. It's just a better form of money. And I think Austrian economics maybe helps us understand this. But I'm not entirely sure that that Bitcoin was designed with the goal of being hard money, with the goal of being Mises approved money. Like, for me, the interesting thing was that Mises and Rothbard had both discussed the idea, or the only ones who discussed the idea that the quantity of money doesn't matter. This is really the most important point about Bitcoin. The quantity doesn't matter in money, that you could have a fixed supply money. But it's pretty clear that Satoshi did not have this as a motivation. He did not cite Rothbard and say, I wanted to make a fixed money supply. He did not cite Mises. And in fact, he mentions it in his his discussions. He says something along the lines of, he doesn't have a way of keeping the supply. I think the issue is that the only way that he could ensure the growth of the supply was to fix the cap. Like, to show that there is no good, to solve the inflation problem in a decentralized way, he had to build the cap. He did not design Bitcoin to build the cap. He designed Bitcoin to function as a payment network. And he if he had found a way of keeping Bitcoin decentralized and keeping Bitcoin decentralized, but protecting it from unexpected inflation, making sure that nobody can inflate the coin supply, he would have done it. Now, this is not very important, but I think I'd like to point it out in that it's unlikely that Austrian economics was the inspiration behind the fixed supply of Bitcoin. But I think Austrian economics helps us understand why this was the solution to the problem of decentralized inflation and why this is just, you know, in other words, Satoshi arrived at the answer of Rothbard and Mises without reading them. Rothbard and Mises had said we can have a fixed supply money. Satoshi tried to build the money, tried to figure out the best way to do it. Without reading Rothbard and Mises, he decided, yep, the only way this thing can work and continue to be decentralized is to have its supply fixed. And I see no reason why having the supply being fixed would be a problem. So he wasn't inspired by Austrian economics, but effectively he agreed with Austrian economics. And it's very difficult to say whether we still get Bitcoin if Mises was not around, or, you know, who knows, the world would have been very different. But I think we would have eventually chanced upon some form of harder money than what we have, because the market provides. And one century of suffering under fiat, I think, is enough. We've earned the chance for a technological alternative to it. So I think eventually we would have, you know, with Austrian economics or without Austrian economics, with Mises or without Mises, monetary technologies get invented all the time. And I think, you know, without Mises, maybe we wouldn't have understood how important it was. Maybe we would have needed another couple of hundred years to figure what's going on. But who knows? What my point is that the invention of a harder money is something that doesn't require Mises to happen. It's something technological. So that's how I would think about it. Having said that, I spoke to Robert, and I think we should get him on one of these seminars at some point and discuss some of his work, because he's got some very interesting writing on Bitcoin and alchemy, and Bitcoin and the number zero, and money as slavery, and how Bitcoin fixes this. It's some pretty good stuff. So maybe we will be discussing it with him at some point. So stay tuned. I guess this is it for today. Thank you everybody for joining. And thank you for the discussion, for the questions. And I will see you next week. Take care.